Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, April 12th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now we'll look at some of the news here around the Cape and the Islands. Patrick, today marks the one-year anniversary of the death of Sergeant Sean Gannon of the Yarmouth Police, who was killed in the line of duty. It's a day for remembrance for many. Your reporter, Jeff Spillane, has a look at how the community came together around this tragic event.
Yeah, the last year has really been filled with some very high-profile events marking the service of Sergeant Gannon and remembering him. These included awards just recently. The Red Cross gave him a Community Impact Award at their annual Heroes Breakfast. He received, he was honored basically at the St. Patrick's Parade, which is a big parade that occurs in Yarmouth every year. There have been other events. The Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Massachusetts honored him. He was a big brother of Big Blues, is I think what they call police officers who take part. And so he was given the Big of the Year. So there were all these very high-profile events honoring him. And, of course, we looked at those, but we also spoke to his mother, Denise Morency Gannon, and she basically said, everything, small or large, where people are remembering her son means a lot to the family. And that really came through, that there was, as much as these large events are a big deal, even the small things. I remember Jeff had interviewed her a while back, and she had shown him a number of the letters that the family had received from all sorts of people from all over the region, state, and country. So, again, for the family, it's not just the big events that matter. It seems like it was the small ones as well.
There were a number of impacts of lasting impacts here that came out of this, including, I guess, the beginning of a state-of-the-art police training facility and some other things, too. Talk about some of these lasting impacts.
Well, if anybody will remember, after Sergeant Gannon's death, he was shot in the line of duty in Marston's Mills, and there was a real cry for change by the legislature, change in the judiciary in terms of how certain cases were handled, having to do with the fact that his alleged killer was out of jail, and a lot of people thought that given his record that he should have been behind bars. And so there was a call for changes in legislation. That's, not led to as many concrete bills being passed as some might have thought at the time. But there have been some things that have happened. You mentioned the training. There was a bill passed, and it was one that had been being pushed for even before Gannon's death, to take money from a rental car fee and put it towards police training. Yarmouth Police Chief Frank Fredrickson had raised that issue. Again, he had been concerned about that even before his officer was killed. And so that was something where they're able to put that money towards training. And there are training facilities now being basically created here on the Cape. One is at the Yarmouth Police Station, and so that is someplace where they're doing some training. And then there's a police training academy that's being proposed for the county at the county level, and so they're moving forward with those two training efforts. But then again, on the legislative side, it hasn't really amounted to bills being passed yet. There are some bills in the works. Governor Baker has proposed and refiled legislation that has to do with bail and how that's handled, and that not only is related to Gannon's case, but to other cases, including the death of Kevin Quinn of Mashpee, who died in a car crash a short time after Gannon's death, and there were some questions raised about the person driving the other vehicle there, and again, bail and all those sorts of issues. So a lot of things have been attempted at this point. One thing that is also in the works is a bill that would allow medics to care for canines, for police canines, because Nero, who was Sergeant Gannon's canine partner, was also shot in that incident back a year ago. And at the time, it was interesting, Kevin Smith, he's a veterinarian, who was kind of instrumental in responding and helping with Nero's recovery. He was actually in a meeting talking about the fact that medics who respond to an incident aren't allowed to care for canines and aren't allowed to put them in the ambulance, for example, or help them if they've been injured in the line of duty. And that's something that he, you know, went quickly from there and was involved in Nero's recovery and thought right away that's something that we can change. And there seems to be a lot of support for that that's moving forward in the legislature from the looks of it.
I want to talk about another story this week, which is the workers at the Stop and Shop. Supermarkets went on strike yesterday. Stop and Shop is a big player among the region's supermarkets. And for some areas here, Stop and Shop is pretty much the only supermarket choice.
Yeah, you can imagine the islands, for example. There's certainly probably issues in terms of a variety or lack thereof of supermarkets. But also people get locked into their local supermarket, and certainly Stop and Shop's a big player. There are 16 Stop and Shops on Cape Cod and the islands who fall under this Local 328, which is part of the union there that's gone on strike. It was yesterday we started seeing things on social media and even getting emails about, oh, the Stop and Shop in Orleans just closed down, the Stop and Shop in Mashpee just closed down. And so what was happening is those workers, after a protracted negotiation that didn't lead to an agreement, over, you know, the typical things, salaries and health benefits and the like, had broken down to the point where the workers yesterday just walked out about 1 o'clock, in some cases, you know, leaving delis with meat sitting there on the counter. And so it was a very sudden event. I think it was meant to be on their part and meant to be a demonstration of the workers and how important they are to the company. The company says they're disappointed because they have a federal mediator who was continuing to work with the two sides and trying to figure something out. But obviously Stop and Shop, big player in the region in terms of supermarkets, and it was something that I think surprised quite a number of people when they tried to go into their local store and couldn't.
Now, the company is, I think, trying to keep these stores open as much as possible using management and some temporary replacement workers. But obviously the striking workers hoping that shoppers don't cross those lines.
Yeah, and it's important to point out that not all of the stores shut down completely. There were managers in some cases, I think, out on the islands who were kind of stepping in, and in some cases, the pharmacy, for example, might stay open and the rest of the store might be closed. But yeah, they're saying they're bringing in, you know, some of their marketing IT personnel to help run the stores wherever they can. They say they had a contingency plan in place. Again, I can't imagine one that fully would replace all of those workers. And even last night, we were hearing on the police scanner from time to time some incidents where people were either trying to go shop at a Stop and Shop, or maybe they were trying to go work at a Stop and Shop, and they were being shouted out at by the picketing folks out front.
And those banks and pharmacies are actually sort of independent businesses located within Stop and Shop. We have word that those are trying to stay open throughout the strike.
Yeah, Citizens Bank is one of those that's inside the Stop and Shops, and you can imagine that they don't want to shut down. More of their branches have become kind of these mini branches in Stop and Shops, so that becomes something that people rely on. And obviously pharmacies, you're talking about somebody's medicine, and that would be something that people would be very concerned about if they were shut down. But it seems like in those cases, they're trying to stay open for those. But it's, it all goes through the same door, so you can imagine they got to open the door for a customer or have the door open for a customer, but make sure they don't go into the grocery area if they're closed down. And we'll have to see what happens today as far as replacement workers go.
We're going to speak right now with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Noah.
Good morning, Steve.
Noah, an islander who many considered the senior statesman of Martha's Vineyard, has passed away. This was Ted Morgan, who was a veteran of World War II and returned to the island to serve his community in many, many ways. Tell us about Ted.
Yeah, so Ted, whose real name was Fred Morgan Jr., he died at the age of 97 last Sunday, having lived what, by all accounts, was a truly remarkable life. And the whole island was mourning all week with the news of his death. Flags in Edgartown flew at half-mast. Tributes, moments of silence, that kind of thing, were made at both selectmen's meetings and town meeting. And Monday, a service that is planned for him at 11 a.m. at the Old Wailing Church in Edgartown. So just a little background on Ted's life. He was born here in 1921, with but what even 1921 was a really long island history. A fun fact is that his father died in what was the old Marine Hospital, which is now the Martha's Vineyard Museum.
The new museum, yes.
Yes. So, but when he was 19, Ted shipped off to the Army right out of high school. He said, really, in a later interview, he had no plans at that point in life, just that he didn't want to be a fisherman. But of course, he would go on to have what was a really long and successful military career, fighting in Europe during World War II. He was a medic and paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne, and if you can believe it, he actually jumped from planes over 25 times on European soil during the war. Yeah.
And then when he returned to the island, he had a military career after World War II, and then returned to the island and really provided public service for a long time.
Exactly. He was a longtime selectman in Edgartown. I believe he was actually one of the longest-serving selectmen in island history. He earned his first term in 1972, and then he didn't retire until the early 2000s. So that's a huge stretch of time to be sitting on a select board. And as you can imagine, he was instrumental in a lot of different pieces of history in both Edgartown and the island. He helped purchase the Katama Airfield, which came up at town meeting this week, incidentally, and spent his career staunchly defending three-acre zoning in the town. And even though he was a lifelong Republican, he did campaign for one Democrat, who was his brother Bob. And then a friend said about Ted that blood ran thicker than politics for him.
Now, the comments under this story on your website are well worth reading, just people chiming in with their memories of Ted.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's remarkable. At town meeting, which I was at this week in Edgartown, the poet laureate Steve Ewing came up and devoted some stanzas to him. One of the things people will probably remember Ted most for was being the steward of the Edgartown 4th of July parade. He would always stand for right at the front. And Steve's poem went right up front every year. The colonel's in his full dress gear. And I think that really just speaks to the kind of role Ted played in the community and how people will remember him.
Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And on the phone with us right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, nice article this week about the successful efforts to create a new home site for a pair of nesting ospreys. This took some doing, some persistence on the part of one woman, and along with the cooperation of a utility company.
Sure. Earlier this year, Eversource installed a deterrent device on a utility pole where this particular pair of ospreys had been nesting. Now, this is right along Route 28 in Harwich, very sort of visible location. Now, these deterrent devices are sort of rounded plastic piping to prevent the birds from constructing a nest on the top of the poles. Now, the utility uses these devices. They try to discourage the birds from nesting on the poles because it potentially can cause fire when the nests interact with the wires, and that can lead to power outages. And actually, sometimes in the past, birds have gotten killed because they've hit an arcing wire, they've hit a wire the wrong way or something. And that's something obviously people don't want to see. But resident Sally Faith Steinman was watching this particular pair of ospreys for a while, and she was watching them this year as they came back, and they tried to nest on this protected pole, but they couldn't do it because their nesting material kept falling off because it was a rounded surface. Now, after watching them for a while, she felt a connection to the birds, and she contacted Eversource and tried to persuade them to put up an alternative nesting platform nearby. Now, Eversource says that they don't have to do this. Under the Federal Migratory Treaty Act, it's legal for them to remove nests as long as there aren't any eggs or unfledged chicks in them. But Steinman took to social media and rallied a lot of support for the for these particular pair of birds, and it wasn't long before Eversource was down there. A representative got in touch with her, and this past Tuesday, a crew installed a new pole about 15 feet away from the previous nesting site. And they actually, the workers there who put the pole up, they helped get the nest started by putting a few sticks and twigs there to sort of encourage the pair to move over to the to their new home. And apparently it worked. Wednesday, Steinman reported that the pair was actively building the nest, and it looks like they're going to settle into this new home. And she said to us that she hoped that the utility will reach out to local wildlife protection groups to try to foster better communications on this issue and maybe come to appreciate the birds a little bit more now that they've seen how resilient they are.
Mm. And ospreys, of course, at one time were quite rare, and now those population is being built back up.
Sure. Well, you know, the population was decimated by DDT in the 60s when they became protected. Their population slowly began to build up. And now, as you know, Steve, you can see osprey platforms pretty much everywhere around the Cape. And that's why I think Eversource doesn't particularly want to encourage nesting on their poles, obviously because of the issues. But it's not as if the birds have... They've staged a pretty good recovery, so they're not worried about individual nests at this point.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
With us from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. Patrick, the first right whale calf of the season has been spotted in Cape Cod Bay. This is a good news story in as much as we didn't see any new calves at all last year.
Not only that, there was a number of deaths in the population in that previous year. They're estimated to be only 411 of these animals in the world, and that's why this is such a big deal when you don't have any calves in one season, you have a number of deaths to then have a calf show up here in Cape Cod Bay. It's proven to the researchers that calf and mother have made the journey from down south where the birthing grounds are. There have been, I still think, only about seven calves reported mm-hmm. born this year. So that's still a number that local researchers from the Center of Coastal Studies, Charlie Mayo, says is too low. They'd love to see more new calves because rebuilding that population is really going to take more births than deaths, obviously, and that's not happening right now. But it was a big deal for them. There was almost a race to see who could spot it first, and it was spotted on a couple days over the weekend in Cape Cod Bay. And that's where these animals come to congregate to feed. And I remember even seeing a tweet from somebody over the weekend who was at a Bruins game, and it was a researcher who said, "I'm at a Bruins game, but I'm thinking about the right whales who you can see right off the shore in Provincetown." Basically, you can go to the beach and see these animals from the shore. Now, you're not supposed to get too close to them, and that's something that came up as well. There was a drone video that was taken of one of these animals off Provincetown. It's a beautiful video, and at the same time, individuals aren't supposed to put drones within 1,500 feet, 500 yards of these animals. The operator of the drone, who's somebody who has supported marine conservation and understands these issues, but wasn't aware of that 500-yard stay-away rule, also wasn't sure what he had. So you can imagine these drones can go a couple miles away from their operator and be above one of these animals, and you might not even know it.
The fellow who took this video, which if you haven't seen, is an amazing video online folks should go look at, he was 2 miles away from the right whale, apparently, when the drone was filming it.
Yeah, that's what he was saying, and if you look at some of the ranges on these drones, they can be, even for the kind of amateur drones that are out there, up to 4 miles or so away. So again, he may be looking at video on his phone and not realizing what he's seeing. I think he said he thought it was an ocean sunfish at first, and then he realized it was a whale, but he didn't know it was a right whale until he got the drone back and really looked closely at the video. So you could see there's probably some wiggle room in there. If you don't know that you're filming over one of these endangered whales, then I guess you might not get into trouble. But the federal regulators are pretty quick to point out that if you know if you're doing this and you're doing it purposefully, you really you could get in trouble, and you're not supposed to do it without a permit, which is what all the aerial surveys are done with, is these permits.
In the video, this whale is kind of lounging and lolling in the water and rolls over, and it's got this great white underside. It's just a remarkable footage.
Yeah, and that's what Patrick Clark, who took the footage, said. He wasn't even kind of aware of how white their underbelly was, or that they had a white underbelly, until he saw this. And the water is crystal clear, which is not, you know, typically usual for around Cape Cod. It can be pretty murky out there. So to see this video that looks like it could have been taken down in the Bahamas, with the kind of brilliance of the colors, is pretty amazing. It's gotten tens of thousands of views on various social media where he posted it.
And it is a rare moment for us right now. You mentioned there are about 411 of these animals, they estimate, left in the wild. And here there's about 150 of them right now in our region, which means nearly half the population is in our waters right now.
Absolutely. And they come here, again, for food, and they come here on their passage. Some of them are now going up to Canada quite a bit more often, it sounds like. But at the same time, the Cape is lucky. We stick out in the ocean, and these sorts of animals come pretty close to shore, and people get a chance to view things that, you know, there are some right whale researchers we've heard who haven't even seen a right whale alive. And so for somebody to be able to go down to, you know, the beach in Provincetown and be able to look out and see these animals or see it, from a boat is pretty incredible.
Let's talk about some offshore wind news. The state of Massachusetts is delaying its decision on the landing point for the Vineyard Wind power transmission cable. And this is something to watch, as the company is really operating on a tight timeline here.
Yeah, they hope to begin construction on this project. It's 84 wind turbines they want to build south of Martha's Vineyard by the end of the year. So they really are pushing ahead, and they're hoping that this delay is, you know, something that isn't going to affect. They say they don't think it's going to affect that timeline in terms of the start of construction. But originally, this decision from the Energy Facility Siting Board, which is tasked with basically analyzing energy projects and deciding if they're environmentally friendly, if they're, you know, economically viable or have a good economics behind them, and whether they improve reliability for electricity in the region, and kind of balancing all those, you can imagine it's pretty complicated. Some of them aren't in line with others in some cases. And they have to do that with each of these types of energy projects. This is the cable, again, that would connect Vineyard Wind through Nantucket Sound and Barnstable to the energy grid. It's now, this decision has been pushed off to May 9th is when the final decision is going to take place. But in reality, this has been a lot less contentious than the Cape Wind Energy Project, and the Energy Facilities Siting Board was a place where there was a lot of discussion and a lot of debate and a lot of fighting over that project. This project, it's been a little smoother. They still do have some fishermen down in Rhode Island who have raised concerns about the alignment of the turbines, but they seem to be a little mollified, maybe begrudgingly so, by a mitigation package that's been offered to them. And so it seems like the project is moving forward. This may be a delay, but they are also looking at federal tax credits that they need to get started by a certain date in order to get a hold of those federal tax credits. And that was a big part of why they were chosen by the utilities and the state to move forward with this project, which was part of this competitive bidding process. So there are a lot of, you know, little pieces to this, but it all has to happen as far as the timing for it to succeed, from the sounds of it.
And the power transmission cable expected to come ashore there at Covell Beach in Barnstable and then wind its way really under some of the town's streets to a new substation.
About 5 miles and to this new substation, and then hooked into an Eversource substation next door, again, to get that power into the grid. Covell Beach was actually the second decision on that front. It was originally thought that it was going to come in via the Yarmouth route, which was kind of the similar route to what Cape Wind had been planning.
Through Lewis Bay, yeah.
Through Lewis Bay. There was some pushback there, some concerns raised. And then they were talking to Barnstable, and they basically were offering a certain amount of money that will go along with coming ashore there. And Barnstable officials said, we'll take it. And so they've alleviated some concerns there about the substation and water issues, it sounds like, and are moving forward with that route for the cable.
We're going to speak right now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning. How are you?
Casey, I'm doing well. A significant piece of land has become available to the town of Truro, but it comes, as you would expect, with a significant price tag as well. Tell us about this.
Sure. Yeah, this is a very rare opportunity in Truro, the smallest town on Cape Cod. The Walsh family is offering the town 70-acre parcel of undeveloped land. Most of it is buildable. It's behind Truro Central School, and it has some cottages in the very front part off of Route 6, the road. But most of it is a huge swath of open land, pine trees with clearings, and it's up for sale with no deed restrictions. The family wants to sell it all, and including their little cottages on it, for $5.1 million to the town. And the selectmen are very excited and have all unanimously approved putting it on the warrant. They say it's a rare opportunity and obviously is the biggest piece of arable land in town. Well, if perhaps there is one larger, but it's huge, obviously, 70 acres. And the town, I guess it came up rather quickly. The negotiations were in private with the family, which is a large extended family, the Walshes, who seem to have owned pieces of the property from the 50s and the 60s and have been holding on to it for a long time, unsure what to do with it. And they have talked to the town in the past about selling certain points. It's come up when the Truro Central School was going to expand, for example, and other times. But Select Board Member Jan Worthington told us that it's just the timing has never been right. And I guess the timing came up rather abruptly right before town meeting. And so now they're trying to buy the land, trying to get voters to approve this large appropriation of $5.1 million. And they have not decided what to do with the land. The Select Board members would like to appoint a committee of citizens to then talk about what exactly to be done with all this acreage if it is indeed purchased. It's an exciting moment in Truro's history.
Is it going to require a Prop 2.5 override, a budget override then?
Yes, it will. It will be a debt exclusion on the ballot for $5.1 million.
Is there a sense of how voters feel about this?
You know, it came up so quickly, honestly. I think there's going to be a forum next Wednesday, April 17th, and let me see what time that is. Yeah, April 17th, 6 p.m. at the Truro Community Center, at which point I think the public is really going to hear for the first time more about the land and what they will have a chance to talk about what they might want to do with it. But obviously, with that kind of acreage, it could be a multitude of things. It could be affordable housing, which is desperately needed in Truro. It could even possibly be some sort of beach parking, because that's also desperately needed with the erosion of the beaches. There could be some open space. There could be some preservation of land for water well usage. It could be an expansion of the school if that ever came up, which is, I think, unlikely without more affordable housing. But I mean, really, it's kind of
a lot of opportunity there. Yeah.
Yes, it's a lot of opportunities. Exactly.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Patrick Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, two Cape wildlife refuges may be open to hunting for the first time. This is a federal government decision, and I guess the one attracting the most attention here maybe is the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge.
Yeah, and it's really, technically, I think the larger of the two. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services says it's considering opening up Monomoy and the Mashpee National Wildlife Refuge to hunting. This is a surprise, maybe a surprise for some, but it's not really, a short time in the making. This is something that's been discussed since a law was passed in 1997, specifically asking that refuges be open to hunting, fishing, and other activities, bird watching, environmental education, etc. Obviously, a lot of people think, oh, well, some of those are going on, but the hunting part of it is what probably would get the most attention. There's an interesting potential irony here. The Monomoy Refuge is a place that the town and state have been basically in a fight with the federal government over, because the federal government had come up with this plan in 2014, I believe, that seemed to indicate, or it did indicate, that it believed it owned a big chunk of land that the town and state say, wait a second, we've been dealing with, issues in that area, and we're the ones who really have jurisdiction over that. So there's been an ongoing fight. There's legislation filed that is meant to kind of make secure that town for the land, or that land for the town. But it's also an area where there's a lot of waterfowl and there's a lot of bird life. And that was one of the reasons why the federal government said that they needed to control it, was to make sure that that bird life was protected, migratory species, et cetera. It's also an area that they're looking at opening up for waterfowl hunting. So some people, you know, look at it and say there might be some irony there. Some town officials kind of said, well, you know, it may be ironic, but the only reason you haven't seen us too upset about it is because historically Chatham residents have been able to access that area for waterfowl hunting, going back to their original argument. And then Jack Clark, who reporter Doug Frazier talked to from, he's from the Massachusetts Audubon Society, said there are other refuges in the country that allow hunting. So this is not something that's totally new. The other aspect of this is one of the things that they're talking about on Monomoy is coyote hunting. And that's something that refuge managers say we're already doing, because coyotes are potentially a threat to endangered species like piping plovers, et cetera. But it's in the context of the state considering whether or not to allow the continuation of these kind of coyote hunting contests that have popped up in the last couple of years here on the Cape. And a lot of people who are upset about that. So, you know, again, this is a proposal, but it's one that seems to be kind of moving forward, and it'll be interesting to see. The other thing about Monomoy is it's largely inaccessible unless you have a boat, and even then it's kind of difficult to land on. So they don't think that a lot of people are going to be taking them up on this offer and going out there to hunt, but you never know. It could be something that people do enjoy doing.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Patrick Cassidy. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Patrick Cassidy. And on the line with us right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you today?
I'm doing well. George, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, too. Thank you.
We talked a little earlier in the program with Tim Wood about a pair of ospreys getting a new nest in Harwich. It's that time of year for ospreys. You've got a nice story about a chance to observe some island birds. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so we're all looking for signs of spring, right?
Yes.
You know, anywhere we can get them, whether it's pinkletinks or osprey or any other wildlife coming out. And so in Oak Bluffs, they've put up a osprey webcam. So you can really get obsessed with this, Steve. I'm warning you right now and the listeners, if you click on this, you may be there for a little while taking a look at it. It's the Oak Bluffs Water District at Lagoon Pond Water Pumping Station. They had to do a little bit of work there during the off season. They took down a nest that was there, and the osprey came back, as they often do, and rebuilt the nest. And they've put up a camera, so we can all a webcam, so we can all take a look. Little insight into this. Brian Dowd, who listeners have heard on your news roundup previously, he was the one who did the little story on this, but he also got the screenshot for us. And there was some hilarity in the newsroom as at one point he saw the osprey return to the nest as he was watching. And he turned to us to tell us, and when he turned back, they were gone. Apparently, you can scare the osprey off even if they're on a webcam. And so it took him a while to get this shot, but he got a great shot of two of them in the nest, which accompanies our little story here. So a little insight for the listeners on how we go about getting some of these things.
And I want to actually touch on a piece of local vocabulary here. You mentioned the pinkletinks. Explain the pinkletinks for folks who aren't familiar with that.
Yeah, some people refer to pinkletinks as peepers. Those are those little tiny frogs that make a heck of a lot of noise in the springtime. Here on the island, there's always a race for people to who have heard the first pinkletinks, and that was about a month ago, actually. So, yeah.
George, one of your reporters and a photo editor there at the paper are pretty keen, it seems, for the new season of the TV show Game of Thrones. Tell us what they did.
I have to, a little bit of a disclosure here. I have never seen an episode of Game of Thrones, so I'm sort of off my game here, but I did want to alert people to this because Brian Dowd again and Gabrielle Menino, they're big fans of the show, and they came up with this great idea to do a Feast of Thrones, taking various things that have been made during previous episodes, and they made their own versions of these. So they give recipes, and Gabrielle put together a fantastic video to accompany this, both from the show and also from their feast. I think the Game of Thrones fans in the audience will love this particular feature, so check it out on our website.
What kinds of things do they come up with for this?
Oh yeah, so they did roasted chicken. Apparently that comes up quite a bit. Chicken Little Fingers, Ira's oysters, and Hot Pies Dire Wolf bread. So and they did bring some of these into the newsroom. Sansa's lemon cakes. They were pretty good. So check it out. There are recipes that go along with it. So if you want to get geared up for Sunday night, you know, you can do it.
George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You too. Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, the towns of Dennis and Harwich and Yarmouth have been working toward an agreement on a wastewater partnership. And this has the potential to be a very big thing in its scope and cost, and to save the towns a lot of money in the long run. But there are details to be worked out just to get this thing set up.
Yeah, this is one of those regional agreements that I think a lot of people were hoping would come out of what's called the Section 208 plan, which was a mandated plan that the Cape Cod Commission came up for towns to work with each other, you know, across town lines on watersheds. In Dennis, Harwich, and Yarmouth, they're looking to build a facility in Dennis and then have the wastewater from the three towns go there to be treated. But, you know, from here to there is a big step and certainly a pretty hefty price tag. This is $1 billion that they're looking at over the next 40 years. These are, you know, some of the towns in the Mid-Cape and area that are going to be pretty big players.
$1 billion over 40 years. So that's
$1 billion over 40
price
years.
Tag, yes.
It is. It's about a quarter or maybe a little less than kind of the overall price tag for the entire Cape. So again, you can see how it stacks up. But by working together, they can potentially save themselves a combined $100 million. So, you know, that's a tenth. That's a pretty good savings if they can work together on this issue and do it that way instead of installing these individual systems that they might otherwise have to do. But a subcommittee of representatives from the three towns have been meeting to draft an agreement. They needed legislation to move forward with the partnership. There was a delay in that legislation, and that allowed them some more time to talk about some of the concerns that were raised about what this would mean. And one of those concerns in particular raised by folks in Harwich and Dennis was that a commission that would be formed to be authorized to spend money and buy land for this project might not have enough oversight from taxpayers or town officials. So they've started tweaking the language of the agreement to potentially address that. And one of the ways that they might address it is a proposed revision that would have a call for an annual joint meeting of the three boards of selectmen from each of the towns to approve the budget proposed by the commission that I was just talking about. So that was one way that they were hoping to give, again, the town some more control over kind of the budget for this, what's going to be a pretty decent-sized project. Does seem like, you know, even with the concerns, it's something that everybody's kind of getting on board for, and it's just a matter of ironing out the details. Still a big project, still one, you know, that has a long way to go before it even begins.
I guess there's a timeline that they're looking at here to get this legislation kind of back to the towns to approve for town meeting.
Yeah, town meeting is always the tricky part. And, you know, once you talk about town meeting and the state legislature and trying to line those two up, you're already facing a bit of an uphill climb. But, yeah, they have to get the information back to the voters to decide on, because in the end, that's another check. Town meeting at each town has to approve going forward with this. And so, you know, there's that check. There's obviously the check at the ballot box when it comes to voting for your selectmen, even, because they'll have, you know, power potentially over that budget eventually. So, you know, there are a few checks that they're trying to put in place just to make sure that some body isn't out there spending money wildly. I think they were concerned about that happening.
And I think they're hoping to get it there for fall town meeting in Dennis and Yarmouth and Harwich there. So they're pushing to get it across the line. A couple of interesting shark stories to talk about here. I have a feeling that we're going to be talking about shark stories pretty much every week from now through summer. But let's start with a story about the reluctance of towns to get involved with so-called technological solutions to managing the shark problem, because it could open them up to liability issues if an attack occurs, by which we mean lawsuits, right?
Yeah, and there had been an effort to raise some money for a basically one of these technological efforts, a pilot program to look at this buoy that would sense sharks when they come into the area. But the person kind of soliciting donations for that said that everybody she talked to kept coming up with the same issue, which was this barrier that had to do with, well, if we put that in the water and people know it's there, or we tell them it's there and it's supposed to detect sharks, they may go in the water thinking it's safe and then turn around and sue the town or whatever organization has told them that that technology is there, claiming that we told them it was safe, you know, and then they ended up getting bit by a shark. So that's the concern, liability. Now, Doug Frazier, a reporter who's been covering this issue up and down for a long time now, talked to some lawyers, and they basically said, well, you know, that it may be an issue to a certain extent, but it's not something that, A, should stop towns from moving forward with things that could potentially protect people going to the beach. And there's a limit. There's been some case law that's been decided that limits towns' liability. Generally, that limits $100,000, and we've seen that play out in other cases. But there's also like a question about what the towns do. The exception to that limit in some cases is when somebody has basically said to somebody, it's assured them that something is going to be safe, and then they go in and do it. So having the technology itself isn't necessarily the problem, but if you had somebody come up to you and say, is it safe to go swim in the water? And you said, perfectly safe, you'll be fine. And then that person goes and gets bit, or in some other case gets injured, then that would be where the issue would raise would come up as far as a larger liability. That's, you would think that's probably the case now with the technology or without the technology. So a lot of folks are looking at this and kind of, you know, saying, well, that liability isn't really the best argument here. There are other arguments. There's a group that's working on an analysis of shark safety measures. And one of the town officials who's been at the, kind of the lead in a lot of this, Dan Hort from Wellfleet, you know, kind of at first talked about the liability issue, but then came back in a follow-up discussion and said, really, I'm waiting for this Woods Hole group to complete their analysis. Problem there is that analysis isn't expected to be finished until after Labor Day, and they're looking at all sorts of technologies and what might work or what might not work. So that's another summer gone by without putting some of these things into place.
And that analysis, the Woods Hole group, the study they're doing is really trying to look at possible management practices that towns can work together to put into place to try to manage this risk and figure out how to know when sharks are in the area or protect beachgoers in some way.
Yes, and again, that could include, you know, who knows, drones. It could include these buoys in the water. It could include, you know, communication systems. All sorts of things could come up in that analysis. But we'll have to wait to see what the outcome of that is until after
summer. Yes,
but not through the entire shark season, because the shark season certainly goes on past kind of Labor Day, and in some cases I think August, September, that's a time of year where they may even see an increased number of sightings.
Well, that kind of brings us to another article by Doug Frazier, which looks at how the highest risk for a shark attack may be in some of the most remote beaches and what the town of Orleans is trying to do to answer that. Again, this is mostly reactive. The town is trying to put in place some reactive steps and also some precautionary steps.
Yeah, Orleans has really been on the forefront, and you can understand why. They have Nauset Beach, this big beach parking lot, very popular destination for beachgoers, and just, you know, north of Chatham and Monomoy, where there aren't as many big of the, you know, or any really big beaches where a lot of people congregate. But Monomoy is where most of the seals are and where a lot of these sharks have been coming to feed. So you can see their next stop as they're moving up the coast is really Nauset Beach in a lot of respects. And so Orleans has been dealing with this for quite a while since it first became apparent that there were sharks in the area. But it is really the buoys that are out there, the detection buoys that are out there being used by the state, have seen a lot of sharks go through that area. And the town has taken some steps, but they're continuing to take more steps. Doug spoke with the fire chief out there, Tony Pike, and the head of their natural resources department, Nate Sears, about new signs that they're now getting. And these are signs coming out of the regional shark working group that includes more than just Orleans. So you assume these will be going up in other places as well. But they're signs that are very much more definitive about the danger. They have a big red line across the top that says warning and then a photo of a shark. In some cases, some of the previous signs, which were, you know, had sharks on them, but also kind of referred to it sometimes euphemistically as marine life. Mm. And in this case, they really have these signs that are very clear. Interestingly enough, they're not only going to be putting these signs on the outer beaches, they're also going to start putting some of these signs on the Cape Cod Bay side, which is an area where they have seen, albeit some smaller great whites. They have seen a number of great whites in Cape Cod Bay, and they're looking at whether that's something that they'll have to worry about in the future. But the other thing that they're doing, you mentioned the remote areas, is they're taking basically trauma kits and going out to some of these remote areas that may be popular with surfers that are further afield from the public beach. 2 miles north of the public beach, there's an area, actually 2 miles south of the public beach, there's an area that has had a buoy and has been one of the most detections seen at that buoy for great white sharks that have been tagged by the state researchers. So the idea is you put a post out there with signs, you have a first aid kit, more than a first aid kit, it's a trauma kit. And they're also encouraging these surfers and other people who use the water out there to take their own trauma kits with them. But the idea is, you know, minutes can count, seconds can count, really. And when you look at one of the people who was attacked by a great white last year, William Lighton, it was, you know, the quick reaction of the people around him, including a doctor, to kind of stem the bleeding that occurred, that they say really saved him from some serious, potentially life-threatening injuries. In the other case last year, of course, there was a fatality where somebody wasn't saved, and who's to say whether that it was even possible, but there wasn't one of these trauma kits right there. There were some nurses in the area, but it was also, you know, it goes to communications as well, and there have been some other actions taken by Orleans, in particular at Nauset, to set up communication lines and to make sure you can basically call 911 from the beach, including, I think, a repeater for Verizon mm-hmm. that was set up so cell phone coverage was better, which has become a big discussion point.
Patrick, I want to touch on one more story here. This is about a shellfish hatchery in Dennis, on which many New England aquaculture farmers depend, and it's finding itself at the end of a rather undependable road. That's not metaphorical. This is a very practical issue for them.
Yeah, this is Aquacultural Research Corporation, and they're basically at the end of Dr. Patero Road there in Dennis, and that road is an area where whenever there's a storm, I think it's one of the places that we swing by to see how it's doing, because sand comes in, water comes in and covers it up. But it's happening quite a bit more, it sounds like, and the folks who run Aquacultural Research Corporation are worried about it. This is an organization that provides the spat, the seeds and shellfish that many aquaculturalists, shell fishermen rely on to seed their grants, and it's a big deal for the Cape and beyond, because it's one of those facilities that is a source of this resource for these many jobs that are created. And so they have to have somebody out there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, because of how delicate it is to grow these seeds. And they also make trips on that road about 60 times a day, which is pretty incredible to think about when you look at the road and look at what kind of shape it's in. Erosion, they've talked about how they've even had to shuttle seeds and oysters across the water that's standing there. They haven't been able to drive out there. They've had to park in other places and walk back and forth to get there, which you can imagine is certainly a time that they'd rather be spending doing something else. So the basically plan is to try and figure out a way to shore up this road, They're talking about potentially putting in some groins in the area. Costs about $2 million. It's not cheap, but the town's looking at potentially doing something along those lines, but they have to get permission from the Army Corps of Engineers. It's a big project, and they're going to see how it goes, but it's something that they feel like they need to do.
It's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick the Maestro, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Steve.
And we spoke with Noah Asimov at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, and checked in with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.